Thank you very much to the organizers here and over there for putting together such an interesting event, for involving me in ways that I hadn't expected, and for, of course, asking me to give the final talk, which is a big honor. Now, the title, as you see, says what we're going to do. We will begin with the Euler characteristic and we will refine it. And the message will be that there are various choices to refine the Euler characteristic, but if you bring in either mathematical physics or a little bit of more algebra, higher algebra, then actually there's a unique choice, and I find that rather rewarding. So I'll begin by refining the Euler characteristic, first doing classical stuff and reminding you of the definition of the complex elliptic genus, which is already a refinement of the Euler characteristic, and then we will push it one step further following some rather recent results by Kachru and Tripathi, who put in a further refinement of the complex elliptic genus. And then we'll bring in more algebra. Up to maybe 2 days ago, this was called higher algebra, but then I chaired all those talks on actual higher algebra, so I think more algebra is more appropriate here. The idea will be that we will bring in some extra structure motivated from mathematical physics, which are actually algebraic. And we will see that there's an alternative to the refinement of the complex elliptic genus that we saw in part one, which from that viewpoint looks more natural. And then only at the very end, I will come to the reason why I find this interesting in my world in conformal field theory. There's actually some use to these results. I'll set things up from a geometer's viewpoint. So I will introduce some notation for the entire talk now. We will be dealing with Calabi-Yau manifolds. M will always denote a compact Calabi-Yau default. Its Euler characteristic will be our starting point. We will also introduce a lot of holomorphic Euler characteristics of holomorphic bundles. And my favorite bundle is the holomorphic tangent bundle, which will be denoted by T. All right, so let's start by refining chi. Well, first agreeing what chi of M actually is in this context here, the most elegant formula maybe arguably is just taking the sum over the Hodge numbers with the appropriate signs. Or if I want to bring in a holomorphic Euler characteristic of something right here, then I can rewrite this a little more efficiently as a sum over holomorphic Euler characteristics of the exterior powers of the holomorphic cotangent bundle. And yet again, I want to write this in a more elegant way, stealing some notation from K-theory. I use these virtual bundles, formal power series with coefficients and holomorphic vector bundles, and of course we'll push it even further. This is just a special case of lambda ye, where y is a formal variable and e is a holomorphic vector bundle, and this is the notation for the formal power series like so. And here I've inserted y equal to minus 1 and the bundle g star in this case. And of course, this is the anti-symmetric powers, and there is a symmetric partner notation to that, which we will use in just a few seconds. So I can just as well introduce it here. Remind you of it here. Okay, so that's the Euler characteristic, and now there's a natural way to refine it immediately. If we've learned all this fancy notation, then we should be courageous and use it. And instead of just the Euler characteristic of lambda minus one t star, we could consider the Euler characteristic of lambda y t star. That's, of course, a classical quantity that's the Hilbert chi y genus. a beautiful invariant for my Calabi-Yau manifold, and it is an invariant, if you know about the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, because it's actually an index of a Dirac operator on your manifold, or just a family if you want to use Y here. And you can view it as our first refinement of the Euler characteristic. When I say refinement, I always mean that I introduce a new variable so that at a special value of this variable, I get back the original Euler characteristic. And here, of course, at y equal to minus 1, we get it back. By using Atiyah-Singer, we can do something which will prove useful later. Namely, rewrite this in terms of function index integral. There we need the subgenus and the churn character. All right. And now to refine this even further to the complex elliptic genus, we just push this one step further. We introduce a more interesting virtual bundle instead of lambda y t star. We just do something more fancy, and that's at least a little abstract definition, which, as I know, in this form goes back to Hilsapoch and Witten. Although, of course, it builds on many other people's work as well. Well, I'm going to use the following virtual bundle, which now has two formal variables, q and y, and it begins with what we're already familiar with, and then we're just going to decorate it a little further. Here's a prefactor to make things prettier later on, and then actually the crucial thing is that we're accompanying this with such an infinite tensor product of things, well, which can be motivated, and I'll say a few words about that in a second. But for the majority of the talk, we'll just take this as something given. Somebody tells us that this is a good virtual bundle to consider here. And then the complex elliptic genus is just defined to be the holomorphic Euler characteristic of this thing, where just as above, I'm extending the Euler characteristic to a ring homomorphism. So you should read that as a formal power series a priori in Q and Y, whose coefficients are the holomorphic Euler characteristics of the bundles that you get when you expand this a little bit horrible tensor product. So that's the elliptic genus, complex elliptic genus. M is just the holomorphic Euler characteristic of this thing, where for aesthetic reasons, I prefer to put a minus one here. And actually, for all matters of using this, this is not really viewed as a formal power series in Q and Y. Instead, we can take it a step further and view it as a function into complex variables tau and z, tau in the upper half plane, z an arbitrary complex variable, and they're related to q and y in the usual fashion that you may have seen in the study of modular forms. Q is e to the 2 pi I tau, and y is e to the 2 pi I z. That's just a cold hard definition, but of course we have to talk about it a little bit. What are the properties of this thing? It's well defined. I'm not going to say that. One has to prove it. But it's actually well defined as a function in these two complex variables, tau and z, with the domain of definition that I told you about. And well, this doesn't come out of nowhere. It is actually the result of trying to define an index of a Dirac operator on loop space. And that doesn't quite work. We've also heard something very related in Lisa Jeffrey's talk. One has to introduce an equivariant index and then regularize a little bit. And then actually what I've written is the result of doing that. So this thing, the complex elliptic genus E, is a regularized U1 equivariant index. Mm-hmm. the drop operator on loop space. So this is kind of much simpler than what Lisa Jeffrey told us about, because here I only have the U1 action. I only have the U1 action on the loop space that rotates in the loops. And then, I mean, the structure of this may look familiar from her talk if you look at it in detail. All right, now we'll do a little calculation, which will prove helpful when we want to understand the properties of this interesting function. And actually what helps here is, on the one hand, the knowledge that we have a Tia-Singer index theorem in the back of our mind. And on the other hand, we can use the splitting principle to identify the total Chern class of T with a product, which is decomposed into the Chern roots, like so. And then we can rewrite that holomorphic Euler characteristic by using Hiltzebos theory of multiplicative sequences, and I'm just going to give you the result of that. You have a product from 1 to d, just like here. D was the rank of that bundle here, because d is the dimension of the Calabi-Yau manifold. And then I start by writing out the contributions from the Todd genus, which I need in the Atiyah-Singer index expression over there. Then we'll get the Chern character, the classical part, if you want. So that's before going to the loop space. We have the prefactor, which I forgot. And actually, I forgot the sign up there. I'm sorry, that should have been minus d here. This one, and now I will add the Chern character of this infinite product, which looks like so. The numerator, we have the contributions from the exterior powers, and the denominator, we have the contributions from the symmetric powers. And I'm writing this out in gory detail, in boring detail, for all those of you who have ever seen infinite products like this and have seen Jacobi theta functions, because that should remind you of the Jacobi theta functions. And indeed, we can rewrite the whole thing very elegantly in terms of Jacobi theta functions, like so. Tells us that the function that I've written for you has nice extra properties, because the Jacobi theta functions have nice modular properties. And actually, from this you deduce that this is modular of weight zero. And it's also elliptic, or rather quasi-elliptic. It's actually a Jacobi form of weight zero and index divided by 2. And that, I think, is most easily read off from the expression that I derived for you. Was there a question? No, okay. All right, so that's one of the results we get by doing the calculation. And next, I want to say it's actually a genus. That's the name. And it means that, apart from being an invariant, which we know anyway, because it's just a concoction of these holomorphic Euler numbers, of stuff that is built from the holomorphic and the holomorphic tangent bundle and its dual. Apart from that, it's also something that is multiplicative and additive. It's multiplicative with respect to taking Cartesian products of the underlying manifolds, and it's additive with respect to taking disjoint unions. So it's a genus with values in the weak Jacobi forms, actually, of weight zero and index c divided by 2. All right, and we have now done our first refinement of the Euler characteristic. yeah, the question was whether this was invariant under complex cobordisms. Yes, it is, although I won't go down that road here because I want to work with Calabi-Yau manifolds and I don't want to, you know, get into the business of asking who has a representative, etc. So for me, yes, of course, there's a whole fancy and beautiful theory behind this going into elliptic homology, etc. But we won't be using that here. Yes, they're integral. The question was whether, sorry, I chaired this session so often and I reminded everyone, no, I don't remember to repeat the question. The question was whether it was integral, and yes, it is. Yes, it is, as you can see from the construction here, because it's just a sum of Euler characteristics when you view it as a formal power series in Q and Y. Okay, so now we have refined the actual Euler characteristic. This is where I wanted to start. We have refined it first to the Hilzebruch-Kai-Y genus, and then we took it one step further to the complex elliptic genus. And from the formula that I wrote for you, you can see immediately that this is an actual refinement, because if we insert z equal to zero, you see immediately that we get back the Euler characteristic of M. And now we're going to refine one more time, and this is following Katru and Tripathi by introducing another variable mu, which when we set this to zero, will give back the original complex elliptic genus. And what they defined, they called Hodge elliptic genus to explain what the basic idea and further refinement here is. Let's do it. Well, when you no, hi. Z is equal to zero. Yeah, but it drops out. That comes out of my calculation here. It drops out, indeed. That's kind of the clue. I mean, I could take the intermediate step and first go to the no loop limit, set Q equal to zero, recover chi y, and then discover chi as a special value there. But no, here we go. Okay, sorry, the question was whether I should have chi y on the left-hand side. I don't. Okay, so now Katru and Tripathi had the following idea, I mean, motivated by a completely other question, but when you look at this, y keeps track of, I mean, nothing particularly deep, y keeps track of the holomorphic form degree in this whole construction over there. And that's a little bit unfair because the anti-holomorphic form degree is not taken care of, although in the cohomology construction there, they're certainly taking a D-bar operator. So they are introducing another operator which takes care of the anti-holomorphic form degree there. And you do it as follows. You decompose E, the bundle, the virtual bundle, into its red pieces. Another question.
How is that as coordinates on the universal elliptic curve? But how is the coordinate on the underlying moduli space? That is the coordinate on the elliptic curve. Is there a Walsh transformation for the D variable?
This is, well, the question is when we can think of this as variables, one on a universal elliptic curve, one parametrizing the curve and one on the curve, whether there is a similar interpretation to that, not that I know of. But you're way ahead. I haven't even introduced it yet. Okay, so to introduce actually this new toy, I'm going to decompose the virtual bundle into its braided pieces. And remember what the complex elliptic genus is. We will have the prefactor y to the minus d half, we will have a sum lm u to the l minus y to the m, and then the holomorphic Euler characteristic of this guy, which is actually just a sum dressed up with the appropriate signs of the dimensions of the cohomology spaces here. So here I still have to introduce a sum over j and minus 1 to the j. So that's our definition of the complex elliptic genus written in a very non-elegant form. But now, actually, I will use a bit of color chalk to introduce the parameter nu, which now will keep track of the anti-holomorphic form degree, like so. And to make it prettier, we put it in like this. So this is the Hodge elliptic gene, where nu is any complex number, and u is e to the 2 pi I nu. And your question was, of course, spot on. I mean, what are the properties now? What are the properties with respect to u? What have we done? We have certainly lost the interpretation of this as an index because we're taking apart the various contributions from the dimensions of the cohomology groups. And, well, it's not clear what we've done here. In particular, a priori, it's not even clear that you have an invariant. However, they can prove this in certain cases. Oops, sorry. They can prove this in certain cases. They show that this is actually an invariant, at least if you're working with complex tori or K3 surfaces. And the deformation of the complex structure, that's the one thing that this could depend on. Because these dimensions could jump when you vary the complex structure. The metric never entered in the whole construction of the complex structure. It's a complex toil or a K3 surface. Then this thing is an invariant. Okay, why would we care? Well, we do care because this complex elliptic genus does feature in, well, conformal field theory, nonlinear sigma models, and actually I gave it away when I told you, still hidden somewhere here, I hope. Yeah, when I told you that we're actually looking at something that was born in the study of loop space. If I say loop space, you should think nonlinear sigma model. So somehow the whole construction of the complex elliptic genus is natural in the discussion of nonlinear sigma models. And when we refine this information, that might be good news for the study of nonlinear sigma models. And that's roughly where this arose in their paper. So let's look at that and let's bring a little bit more algebra into the game. Or mathematical physics, if you want to use those words here, because, well, I mean, if I could, I would now start assigning nonlinear sigma models to my Calabi-Yau manifolds and then discussing properties of these quantum field theories. But that's mathematically, of course, slightly dangerous ground. And we're lucky here to study these kinds of invariants. We don't need to write out the full-fledged superconformal field theory. So we'll keep it at slightly lower level, at least for the most part of the talk. And we will ask whether we can associate to our Calabi-Yau manifold, maybe the supervertex operator algebra, or maybe more of those. So now we are almost in the realm of topological field theory. Let's see what exactly we're doing in a few seconds. First, I want to introduce the basic ingredients to what we're going to do. Namely, basic ingredient copied from or taken from topological field theory, indeed, namely the famous BC beta gamma systems, which some of you, I think, know. And I will call my BC beta gamma system just E. Now, for the benefit of everyone who is not so familiar with this, I'll say a few words about the construction, just as much as we will need to match it up with the geometric approach that I took earlier. So let's construct part of the structure of E. And I'll begin by constructing F as part of E, the bosonic part of E. F will be a complex vector space, an infinite dimensional one. And well, I'll formulate everything in a form that mathematicians don't like so much, but it's very, very convenient in this setting here. I'll formulate everything by choosing an appropriate basis. That's all a big cheat because all I'm doing now is going to label things so that everything is convenient later on. So with basis. Labeled as follows. I have a couple of B's entering. I have a couple of A's entering, like so. And N1 up to NJ, M1 up to MK. These are just labels in the integers. But here they're going to be ordered. And NJ must not be negative, and MK must be positive. So, okay, that's just a not very fancy way of saying that I'm introducing a countable basis for this complex vector space. But the whole point is that I want to have it in a form that one can easily see that this is actually an induced representation of a Lie algebra on a induced from a one-dimensional representation. A here is going to be the Lie algebra with basis given by the A's and the B's, together with one central element, 1. Now we take all the integers here. And the only non-trivial Lie bracket over here is the one between an and bm if n plus m is 0. And all other basic Lie brackets are trivial. So that's the Lie algebra A. Underscore for me is the one-dimensional representation of a maximal abelian subalgebra of A. So C, I would conveniently build on that basis vector omega. And on here, we have an action of the Lie subalgebra A minus generated by some of the A's, some of the B's, and the central element. Actually, the A's will be acting trivially. And we take, A's had labels M, labels N. So we need to take everything that wasn't listed there. M is less than 0, and EN is 0 for N less. I got it wrong now. No, I got it right. Okay, and 1 is the identity. And these are the generators of the Lie algebra, A minus. So as I said, I mean, working with the spaces up there will be useful in a few minutes. But I mean, this is just a fancy way of saying that we have a less fancy way of saying that we have an induced representation of a very simple one-dimensional one. And those of you who have ever worked with vertex operator algebras will have seen this example of a Fock space, and they know that F is actually carries a vertex operator algebra structure. Is a vertex operator algebra built from two basic fields, three fields. A and B, whose coefficients are just the An and the Bm. Okay, that's F, that's the bosonic part of what I need. E is going to be the full, that's actually called a BC system in the physics literature. And E is going to be the BC beta gamma system, which arises if you accompany A and B by two fields, beta and gamma, which are fermionic, but all everything else works just the same way that I explained, only that then we make a super Lie algebra out of the Lie algebra, and the corresponding coefficients will obey anti-commutators, super Lie brackets instead of the Lie bracket that I had there. So E arises by accompanying A and B by fermionic fields beta gamma completely analogously. So what is the connection to what I told you in part one? Nothing very obvious at this point. But now the point is that we can try, we won't be successful, but we can try to make a bundle of vertex algebras out of this virtual bundle or something that is related. Because what we could do, we could just work locally first of all, for a holomorphic coordinate chart in M. Choose it small enough so that the holomorphic tangent bundle trivializes, so E also trivializes over there. Make it small enough so that E trivializes. Then actually, the fiber here does look almost like a BC beta gamma system. Because look, what are the ingredients of E? E is almost like E. Well, maybe we need D copies because, of course, we're working in D dimensions. So each of these tangent and cotangent bundles have to be trivialized, make U small enough so that this is the case, and each of them has rank D. And then, well, the ingredients that we have here, for instance, are these symmetric powers. These symmetric powers of the holomorphic tangent bundle and the cotangent bundle. So I will call this SQM D star. And when you look at the construction here, you could model this by using the modes of B. But you need D copies of that because some here are rank D. So take symmetric powers of this to model the contribution from here after trivializing U. And of course, then for T, if you replace T dual by T, you can use the modes of A analogously. And for the exterior powers, we use on modes of the fermionic fields. So that looks all very nice until you look at the details. There's one crucial difference between E to the D and the bold face E. And I tried to be very careful. I hope I managed here on the blackboard. I tried to be very careful to choose the M's and the N's properly. M up there is always positive. There are zero modes of the B's, and there are zero modes of the betas. And here, the only thing I get are the zero modes of the betas, because there's no factor sq to the zero in this virtual bundle. It's just not there. So careful, this is not quite the setting in topological field theory. And I'll get to that in a minute. Because, I mean, maybe we don't care that much, and indeed one can now construct something like a bundle out of this idea here. You can use the fact that we're working on a Calabi-Yau manifold, and it means that we have SUD holonomy, so you can use, instead of your usual vector bundle here, you can express everything in terms of a principal SUD bundle. Now you use this standard fiber here, make a vertex operator algebra out of it, or module of a vertex operator algebra, and then you can construct a principal bundle out of this. So you can construct a principal SUD bundle of super VOA modules out of this. And this was done probably earlier at the work I'm using here is Kreuzig and Höhn. So at least, I mean, we're associating something that looks similar to the BC beta gamma systems, and that's good news because I want to somehow model a little bit of the ingredients of nonlinear sigma models, and that looks good until I look into the details, because this is not quite the setting in TQFT, because the indices were chosen so that m is always greater than zero, n is greater or equal to zero. So in E, we are missing the zero modes of B, which are there in topological field theory. Okay, so this is beautiful, and this is actually what one should think of as the structure underlying the refinement of the complex elliptic genus that Kachru and Tripathi were suggesting, because they work really with this bundle EQ minus Y with the formula that I wrote for you. That's actually the setting they have, and I'm saying we shouldn't be surprised if we don't quite see all the structure of TQFT there. But what we can do, I mean, this is not a big deal, because of course we can still work with the local coordinate neighborhoods here. We can still attach d copies of a BC beta gamma system to every local coordinate neighborhood and make a sheaf out of it. And that works is a very important insight by Malikov, Schechtmann, and Weintraub. Show that one can use this idea. I mean, bring the zero modes of B back in and just work in the sheaf language and construct a sheaf by gluing local BC beta gamma systems like up there. So gluing the sheaf is called the chiral Durham complex. I'll make sure that it gives me d copies of BC beta gamma systems over every local holomorphic coordinate neighborhood that is small enough, like up there. One obtains with U as above. One obtains a sheaf. Of super vertex operator algebras called the chiral Durham complex. Because it is actually a chain complex, it's a chain complex that is quasi isomorphic to the usual Durham complex. So that's why we have this name. It's, the sheaf is not quasi-coherent. So that's actually a problem when working with this, but it comes with a natural filtration. It's filtered. And then the associated graded module is exactly the EQ minus Y that we had up there with associated graded. So now I don't want to introduce too much extra notation, but there are two linear operators constructed from the BC beta gamma systems, which actually give global operators, which are responsible for these gradings here, and they're familiar to those of you who are working in conformal field theory. So there's a zero mode up of zero zero in this topological setting, and there's a J0, which are responsible for the grading counted by Q and Y respectively. And actually, all this descends to sheaf cohomology. Okay, so that's the structure that we have, and it's a little more complicated than what we get when we work in this bundle language. And this also tells us that we can immediately connect to the complex elliptic genus. We already know that we get the complex elliptic genus from EQ minus Y. So taking a graded Euler characteristic of the homology of the chiral Aram complex, we get the very same thing. So we get inclusion. We can also calculate the complex elliptic genus by taking a graded Euler characteristic of the sheaf cohomology over there. So this would be y to the minus d half, take the sum over the traces over hj for the chiral Aram complex, and insert those operators we use for the grading. And you see, I mean, we have a filtered complex, so we can construct a spectral sequence if we want, taking just working with the graded object here. We're just not pushing it to the left. So we're kind of stopping a little early when you're working here, but we're approximating the sheaf cohomology in a certain sense. But we shouldn't expect each and every single contribution here to agree with the type of cohomology we've used up to now in order to construct the complex elliptic genus. So I think from this perspective, a refinement of the complex elliptic genus is more natural when we work with the chiral Aram complex. It's more natural to refine this equation here by introducing the variable u exactly the same way that Kachur and Tripathi taught us, but we should do it in the chiral Aram complex. So that's a definition which I find natural. I say we introduce the chiral Hodge elliptic genus. It has three variables, tau, z, and u, and is constructed just as I told you. We must ask, what is it good for? Is it even anything new? Is there a difference to the original Hodge elliptic genus? So I want it on chiral here. Is there a difference, and is it an invariant? I can show it's an invariant in the case, again, with respect to deformations of the complex structure. It's an invariant in the case where Kachur and Tripathi know, as a result. This is an invariant for complex tori and for K3 surfaces. Actually, for complex tori, I get exactly back the same invariant that Kachur and Tripathi had. So for complex tori, I didn't do anything new. For K3 surfaces, I also get an invariant, and it does differ from the Hodge elliptic genus of Karlsruhe free party. Okay, three surfaces. The chiral Hodge elliptic genus is an invariant different from the Hodge elliptic genus. And I should say, actually, all the technical steps for proving this are written up in other people's papers. So in some sense, I was lucky. I only had to put together the pieces of what other people had already done. So this uses very, very crucially the work by Kreuzig and Hoehn. And I cited before, because actually I get an explicit formula for the Hodge elliptic genus for K3 surfaces, and then I compare to the explicit formula for the chiral Hodge elliptic genus, which I get from works by Bailin Song, who actually calculated the chiral Durand complex for K3 surfaces, and that's incredibly useful. Okay, the question is whether this is a family of modular forms. Well, for K3, the chiral Hodge elliptic genus is a mock modular form. For the Hodge elliptic genus, it probably is as well, but there's no proof of that. So no, it's not a family of modular forms. It's actually, and you destroy modularity by introducing this new variable. So a priori, I mean, it's fair to ask what's the use of it, you know, but I mean, at least it's something that gives more structure to, what we knew about these things that smell a little bit like topological field theory. And for me, the reason is that actually I can use these things to study conformal field theories associated to Calabi-Yau manifolds. Let me tell you why. So I want to give a brief idea of what the interpretation of this or the use of this in conformal field theory might be. This will be a little vague. I mean, I have 10 minutes left and it's the end of a very long week. I will try and tell you how it fits in. So now we have to get our hands a little bit dirty, because it fits in where we use the string theorist's hope that actually to any Calabi-Yau manifold, one can associate a superconformal field theory by a nonlinear sigma model construction. And when I say superconformal field theory, I mean we're in dimension two, we're unitary, we have n equal to 2 world sheet supersymmetry and space-time supersymmetry. So I would have to spend quite a bit of time to say exactly what I mean here, that I can phrase it all out in terms of the representation theory that enters the right-hand side, and we have a central charge, which depends on the dimension over there. Namely, 3 times d. Okay, so if we have a superconformal field theory in our hands, of course, I mean, we can abstractly say what this is, but it's still a complicated object, and it's a good idea if we want to talk about invariants like the ones that I introduced here to simplify a little bit. And the simplification here is Witten's topological half twist. Because that brings us back into the area of vertex operator algebras. So we get then, as part of the space of states of the original conformal field theory, still an infinite dimensional vector space which carries interesting representations of the super-Virasoro algebra and other things. But this actually is almost a super-vertex operator algebra. And in particular, the three linear operators coming from the superconformal algebras up here that survive the topological half-twist and that will be relevant for what I have to say are three operators that look familiar, I hope. J0, L0 topological, and J0 bar. So I've topologically half-twisted the anti-holomorphic ingredients. That's why there's no L0 top bar left, because that's completely zero over here. But just for matters of notation and because it's more elegant, I'm also using this operator here instead of L0. So this is actually, for everyone who's not familiar with this language, this is just an infinite dimensional vector space where we have three beautiful linear operators. They all commute, and they're all simultaneously diagonalizable over here, and each simultaneous eigenspace is finite dimensional. And it gets even better, all the eigenvalues are integers. So things become actually much simpler over here. And one can then introduce a gadget that should look vaguely familiar, namely what we call the conformal field theoretic elliptic genus of the superconformal field theory, curly C over here. And that's just, well, we have a prefactor depending on the central charge. And other than that, we have a trace over this space and then things that look familiar. And we can define this thing for any superconformal field theory if we have our notion of supersymmetry right. I don't even need the nonlinear sigma model construction here. If I have my definition right for the superconformal field theories, then this is always well defined and gives us a weak Jacobi form of the right weight and index. And whenever we have moduli in the game, whenever this depends on moduli, so we have a good deformation theory of this, these superconformal field theories over there, then the topological half-twist will still depend on the moduli, and that's important, but this guy won't, an invariant. So here I mean, doesn't change when you play with the moduli. And of course, we have naturally moduli in the game when we're in this nonlinear sigma model picture. We just take the geometric moduli of M and everything will depend on that. So now you shouldn't be surprised by all the structure that I have introduced if I say that one expects the complex elliptic genus of M to agree with that conformal field theoretic elliptic genus in the case where we're in this nonlinear sigma model picture. So expect in star that the complex elliptic genus agrees with the conformal field theoretic elliptic genus. And this is known to be true in those cases where we have that picture under control for complex tori, where we can actually make the nonlinear sigma model construction work gory detail as much as we wish for complex tori. But also to a certain degree for K3 surfaces and M equal to K3 if C is what we call a K3 theory. Now I would have to add half an hour of a lecture on K3 theories and superconformal field theories. I'm not going to do that, but I need to send the message that we can give an abstract definition of what it means to be a K3 theory without using the nonlinear sigma model language over there. So that's purely in terms of representation theory. I give a few extra conditions on the type of representations that are in the game there. And then actually this comes out well, almost by definition, so it's a bit of a cheat. We shouldn't be too proud of the fact that we have agreement here and implement that into the definition. But at least we have agreement. So sometimes this is correct.
This does depend on the complex structure, or it doesn't?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It's invariant. It's in that. This one depends on the complex structure, but in this weighted sum, the dependence drops out. So there are lots of cancellations. That's why I definitely need this sign here. Okay. Yeah, I was supposed to repeat the question. The question was of whether things depend on the complex structure. Sorry. Okay, but now we are, of course, encouraged to play this whole refinement game in the CFT language. So let's refine the conformal field theoretic elliptic genus. And that was also done by Cacciaro and Picotti. And that's now even more natural than what we've seen before. We take the Hodge elliptic CFT genus, and that's going to be something in three variables, and I just democratically introduce the extra variable u and copy whatever I had over there. Oh, this wasn't completely correct, I'm sorry. This was supposed to be just a minus one here. I'm sorry. And now the minus one is being replaced by u. Okay, so that's their definition. And originally they hoped to have CFT counterpart of their geometric Hodge elliptic genus. However, that's very easy to disprove because this guy now does depend on the moduli. I mean, good that you asked a little earlier. I said that the space here depends on the moduli, but that the moduli dependence drops out because I have these beautiful signs over there, and I should have noticed the mistake at that point. But now when we introduce the parameter u, things do depend on parameters, and it's very easy to see that in any example that we have under control. So this is not an invariant. And you should also be suspicious because of the other things that I told you. I mean, you shouldn't expect this to relate to the geometric Hodge elliptic genus that Cacciaro and Tripathi introduced. Actually, if things work out nicely, then this should relate maybe at best to the chiral Hodge elliptic genus. And actually, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to keep that short. So what I can show is that actually, well, for tori, there's nothing to say because everybody agrees anyway. But for K3 surfaces, when you tune the moduli of the conformal field theory to generic moduli, then you get the chiral Hodge elliptic genus. So let me write that out. The Hodge elliptic genus is CFT for K3 theories. When you tune it to generic moduli, then you get the chiral Hodge elliptic genus. And that's actually very, very rewarding because now on the one end, I mean, ends are meeting because I'm making contact between conformal field theory and these geometric quantities that I introduced. And on the other hand, it's very useful for me because I study conformal field theories on K3. And one can use this result to argue that actually the sheaf cohomology of the chiral Durham complex on K3 surfaces can be interpreted as a generic subspace of this space H here, a generic subspace. For K3 series. Meaning at non-generic points, the space becomes bigger than that one, gets extra contributions, but the contributions that are accounted for in the sheaf cohomology of the chiral Durham complex, they are shared by everybody in the K3 theories. And that could be very useful. We have a good definition for K3 theories. We know that they live in an 80-dimensional moduli space, but for most of those theories, we have no clue how to construct them. And now at least we have a construction of a generic subspace, which by results of Borisov and Lipkober even carries the structure of a vertex operator algebra. It's a little hard to study that, so I don't know much about this vertex operator algebra yet, but that's of course going to be the next step, because that will somehow enter in the properties of the K3 theories that really I want to understand, but I'm a little less ambitious right here. Okay, so I think I'm out of time, and I think I will end right there. Thank you very much. Any questions? I'm the final speaker, and it's my honor and my duty to ask you to give a big hand to our organizers for putting together a really, really wonderful conference, which I enjoy. Thank you.
Are there any questions on this side? Okay, I think we'll turn it over to MPI then.
Okay. So let me open the question session to the Canadian audience.
I think we're doing our
email. Okay, we should mute it then. It's Lucas's job. It's Lucas's job. Okay, I'll do
I've ended my talk.
I think we're muted then.
Okay.
I'll try to talk, and we'll just appreciate that technology is difficult. So I just wanted to say a few things since this is the last talk of the conference. So we all wanted to really thank MPI and PI both for being willing to host this sort of experimental formatted conference, and thanks to you all for being willing to participate and giving of all of the technical difficulties that we should run into and this sort of thing. Thanks to all of the speakers for giving talks and being willing to interact through both sides. So the polls will be open until 4 p.m. today, and then it'll be 10 p.m. over there, so we'll close them off. And also, at 4 p.m. on Fridays is traditionally an informal
social
weekly social. So whether or not that's actually happening, we can all agree to hang out there if anybody wants to. That's true. Am I missing anything? I think we're just missing those. So we'll be sending feedback forms by email. It's really, really helpful if you all can give us your input, way more now than most conferences. You might just dash off a few sentences, but this is crazy and different, and we would love to consolidate the institutional knowledge that we've all accumulated just by being here. And so we would really appreciate your participation in that. Okay, thanks a lot. Thank you. We'll open it up also to questions, just one-on-one, if you want to walk on.
Let's see. I'm not trying to Canadian audience. Are there any questions for Kevin Stock from Canada?
Well, I think we're all set.
Yes.
There was a remark about you made about quasi-isomorph fields.
Irish year and normal around conflict, but then you get the structure of the cosmology of the Irish year. So I, something I don't know.
So there's a question about the various types of cosmology that we can take here. So this is actually a chain complex also, and I didn't tell you what the boundary operator was. The boundary operator actually mimics immediately the Durham boundary operator that you have in Durham cosmology. When you calculate the cosmology with respect to that boundary operator, then we're talking about quasi-isomorphy with the Durham complex. Here I'm using sheaf cosmology.
Richer.
Much richer. That's infinite dimensional.
More questions? Let's give a warm applause to you. Okay? I'd like to remind you all to return your participant cards because it's money, so you can either leave them at the reception or the letterbox. And, well, long distance travel for short term interaction is bad for our well being and has adverse effects on global warming, contributes to all the negative consequences. This conference was an attempt. Was an experiment, and we hope that it will serve as an inspiration and blueprint for people. Okay, so that's it. Thanks for participating.